Ashton is just a typical small town. But when a skeptical reporter and a prayerful, hardworking pastor begin to investigate mysterious events, they suddenly find themselves caught up in a hideous New Age plot to enslave the townspeople and eventually the entire human race. The physical world meets the spiritual realm, and the battle rages between the forces of good and evil. So reads the dust jacket of author Frank Peretti's first Christian horror novel. Published in the mid-1980s, the book was titled This Present Darkness. Maybe you've heard of it before. The title was taken from Ephesians 6:12, which it quotes on the inside cover. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Peretti's story focuses on spiritual warfare and the unseen battle that wages between angels and demons. Surprisingly, the Bible actually has relatively little to say about the activities of angels or demons, and even less to say about their interaction with one another. We saw a little in our study of the book of Daniel, but there's been relatively little said since then. I mean, an angel may pop up to deliver a message from God, and then he's gone. Or we may find, as Jesus is walking around, he comes across a demon, a person who's been possessed by a demon, he casts him out. That's about it. But our text today is once again going to enter into this spiritual realm. It's once again going to pull back the curtain ever so slightly to give us just a glimpse of these heavenly messengers, the angels, and their acts in history to restrain evil. So if you will, turn to Acts chapter 11, where we'll find the prologue of our portion of the story today. Acts chapter 11, and I'm going to begin in verse 19. Acts chapter 11, 19. So then, those who were scattered because of the persecution that occurred in connection with Stephen made their way to Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch, speaking the word to no one except Jews alone. But there were some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, who came to Antioch and began speaking to the Greeks also, preaching the Lord Jesus. And the hand of the Lord Jesus was with them, and a large number who believed turned to the Lord. As you recall, Stephen was the first martyr of this new community we call the church. And when that took place, this body that had been gathering together in Jerusalem as a church was scattered. But at that time, the door had not yet been opened, as the text reminds us, to the Gentile world. The apostles had not yet gone and unlocked it with the keys to the kingdom to give the go-ahead for the message to go to the Gentiles. But after last week, when we saw Peter's encounter, 2 weeks ago, when we saw Peter in his encounter with Cornelius and the way that the Lord revealed to him that, yes, indeed, the Gentiles are to be recipients of the repentance that leads to life. The Gentiles are recipients now of the Holy Spirit that was promised to Israel. Therefore, the Gentiles should be baptized and added to the community. We saw that took place, and not only was Peter convinced, but those who were with him were convinced, and ultimately the elders who he came and talked with in Jerusalem, who took account with him for meeting with these Gentiles and eating with them, they too were convinced. They said, okay, well, it looks like God is doing a new thing, an unforeseen thing, an unexpected thing. The Gentiles are part of this new community. Now we see the gospel beginning to spread to Gentiles. It's starting to go out unhindered. And we see the text says, the hand of the Lord was with them, and a large number who believed turned to the Lord was with those who were going to Antioch, speaking to the Greeks. It's an interesting phrase, the hand of the Lord. You may recall, we saw this thing popping up a lot in the book of Ezra. You might recall Ezra was that individual who set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to follow it and to teach it to Israel. And he operated against incredible odds in order to restore the returning Israelites, the returning exiles, to restore them back to obedience, back to faith in God. And said that, and the explanation for why Ezra had such success in his endeavors in leading these people and in speaking for these people, even to the king, was because the hand of the Lord was the one doing it. He had God backing him and giving him success in his endeavors. Now you may think, as I do, you know, I want to be like that. I want to have God's hand on me. I want to be operating with the power of the Lord. I want to be operating with His backing, causing my endeavors to serve Him, to be successful. Well, Ezra says that's very simple. If you want that, you can certainly have it. Just listen to this. These are his words to the king. Because the king at the time, the Gentile king, wanted to know what the secret of his success was. And Ezra tells him. He says, look, this is Ezra chapter 8, verse 22. He says, look, the hand of the Lord our God is on everyone who is seeking Him. But His power and His anger are against all those who forsake Him. He says, if you want to have God's hand behind you, if you want to walk in a manner that serves and promotes God's plan and His purposes, seek Him, serve Him. Now the contrary side is, if you're not on God's team, if you're not setting your heart to follow and to serve the Lord, well, you need to realize that that means that you are His enemy. His hand will not be on you, it will be against you. So you can either get the front of the hand or you get the back of the hand. You get to choose. But you make that decision. Now, the gospel is freely going out to the Gentiles in the book of Acts. We find verse 22, the news about them reached the ears of the church at Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas off to Antioch. We remember Barnabas. He is the man of encouragement. He is this faithful follower in the New Testament church, a landowner who gave up his land, laid it at the apostles' feet, the one that was contrasted with Ananias and Sapphira, the one who backed Saul when people were kind of questionable about, hey, is this guy really a believer, or is he trying to infiltrate us in order to capture us and lead us back to be judged and then executed? We see Barnabas pops up and he's sent out. You know, we hear something's going on in Antioch. We hear that there's been a good reception in the church. Go check it out. He heads that way. There's such a good reception that Barnabas says, I need help. And notice who he goes to get. This is verse 25. He left for Tarsus to look for Saul. And when he had found him, he brought him to Antioch. And for an entire year they met with the church and taught considerable numbers. And the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. Now that is an impressive discipleship program. In a year's time, you have these people, predominantly Gentiles, who are so involved and have gained so much understanding and are responding so positively to the Word that the community surrounding them has given them a nickname. They say, these guys are walking around and they look like Jesus wannabes. You know, they're Christians. That is, little Christs. You guys look like a bunch of little Christs. We might say they look like Jesus freaks. You know, that movement in the 90s where you have people like Jars of Clay, and there's that rumbling amongst the younger Christian community that are saying, hey, you know, we've been attending these institutions of faith that talk a lot about theology, but we don't see it acted out in practice. So they, you know, had their little Jesus freak movement. They're saying, you guys look like a bunch of Jesus freaks. You know, you look like a bunch of Christ-like followers. That's a successful program. I find it interesting here that the first place, and really the first Christians, I mean, Sir Paul and Barnabas and others were there of Jewish origin, but if we're talking about a predominantly Gentile location, we're also acknowledging the fact that most likely the first folks being called Christians were Gentiles. The first folks that were being identified as followers of the King of Israel, who will rule over the world, was not a large community of Jews, which you would think, because it would be, this is our political king. You know, this is the one who runs us and he's going to run y'all too. So we wear his jersey. No, no, it's people from the other aisle. People who are not native to the hope of Israel and Israel dominating. These are Gentiles. People coming from Satan's team and saying, this ain't it. Caesar ain't it. You know who's it? The king of Israel, who isn't currently here. The king of the nation that's being dominated by Rome, that's whose team I'm on. And as a community, their culture is inundated with this belief, and they are identified then as Christians. It's the Gentiles that were the first to be called, along with Barnabas and others, of course. Now notice at verse 27. Now at this time, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them named Agabus stood up and began to indicate by the Spirit there'd be certainly a great famine all over the world. And this took place in the reign of Claudius. And in the proportion that any of the disciples, this is just talking about the believers in Antioch, had means, each of them determined to send a contribution for the relief of the brothers living in Judea. And this they did, sending it in the charge of Barnabas and Saul to the elders. So the Gentiles now, having benefited from the spiritual things that were promised to Jews in Jerusalem, are now gathering together their material things in order to care for their Jewish brothers. They're rallying up their funds because they're having great difficulty, as we will find soon, in Jerusalem. So they're gathering up to care for the Jewish believers. The Gentiles are now taking care of the Jews. Now notice it. Chapter 12. That's the prologue. Here's what's going on in Jerusalem. We see that there's success in Antioch and Gentile land. Now, about that time, the time that they're gathering up this money to come and love on the folks in Jerusalem, the Christians are, Herod, the king, laid his hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now, it was during the days of unleavened bread. And when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out before the people. So Peter was kept in prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church of God. Now I look at this. We see that persecution is now escalating in Jerusalem. I ask, who is this James? We've already lost Stephen. Now here comes the second Christian martyr, James. Well, it's not the one who wrote the book of James. You know, we think of the brother of Jesus. This is James, the brother of John. Do y'all recall the sons of Zebedee, the sons of thunder, the one whose mother approached Jesus and said, hey, in the kingdom, can my son sit on your right, on your left? He says, hey, that's not mine to give. Can you drink the cup the Father's going to give me? So then they said, oh yeah, we can do that. He says, okay, you'll drink the cup, but it's not my decision whether you're going to sit on the right or the left. Well, now we have the death, the execution by the state of one of the sons of thunder. You know, you think of these strong individuals. He's taken out. He was an apostle. Okay, this isn't just a disciple. And it's not just, you might recall, it was a Hellenistic. Stephen was a Hellenistic disciple, kind of an outsider. Now we're on the inside. A Jew's Jew. Anyone is fair game. And we say, well, why is he doing this? And why is Herod making himself an enemy of the church, and particularly an enemy of the apostles? You know, next he goes after Peter. Why? Well, verse 3 tells us, because he saw that it pleased the Jews. Herod, as the king, is trying to curry favor of his Jewish constituents, and the way that he can do it then is to make himself an enemy of their enemies. He finds that, hey, if I persecute this group over here, the Sadducees, the high priest, all these people that have been ticked off by Peter and the apostles and the Christian movement, they become my friends. So he's trying to curry favor, and he pulls out Peter, he's going to throw him in prison, and he's going to try to execute him. Now notice what happens. Verse 6. On the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell. And he struck Peter's side and woke him up, saying, get up quickly. And his chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, gird yourself and put on your sandals. And he did so. And he said to him, wrap your cloak around you and follow me. And he went out and continued to follow and did not know that what was being done by the angel was real He thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself. And they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from them. And when Peter came to himself, he said, "Well, now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who is called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. So the church is gathered together. It's late at night. They are praying for Peter. They are concerned for Peter. They are concerned for his welfare, for his future. Meanwhile, Peter, verse 6, is asleep. He's knocked out. He's got a soldier on either side. He's not worried. He's out. He's enjoying some shut-eye. And then suddenly, we find in this maximum security prison with two guards on the front, on the back, with two soldiers, we suddenly have a prison break. And it is not one that is instigated by Barnabas and Saul who have come to visit the city. It's not one that is instigated by any of the other apostles. It's not one that's instigated by the local church. They're just having a house prayer meeting. That's what they're doing. This is a prison break that is orchestrated by God himself. And he sends an angel to do it. Now, I saw on Fox News just this week that there is a family in Michigan that claimed to have caught a picture of an angel hovering over their truck with their house security video. And that seems like an awful strange assignment to me. I don't think that there is some kind of eternal weight placed upon trucks. But they think they caught the picture. I saw the picture. I think it's probably kind of like, y'all remember that dress that you look at and some people see a blue dress and some people see a gold dress? Have any of y'all seen that? It's kind of bizarre. You know, if you haven't seen it, you should look it up. I think it's kind of like that, because a lot of people look at this picture and they say they see an angel, but when I look at this picture, all I see is a moth. So if you want to see the picture of a moth, you can go and you can look at this later. But here we find in our text, we get information from the biblical story about an angel, what they're like, what they're about. This is one of the most detailed accounts regarding an angel in the New Testament. So if you're interested in angelology, this is a text for you. You know, we get four whole verses involving the angel, and then we're going to get a bonus one later to make it a nice round number. Verse 7, we find that the angel suddenly appeared in the cell. It suddenly appeared. Now, verse 10 is sure to mention that the iron gate that led out of the city was still closed. It was still closed, so that means the angel didn't just walk in to Peter's cell by foot. He appeared. Suddenly, he manifested himself in Peter's cell. And then suddenly, we have a light that is shown. So the angel glowed. He's like a night light. He glows in the cell. And I wonder why that is. Now, it certainly could be the case. We've looked at angels before, again, in the book of Daniel. And they are certainly mighty, terrifying beings. It certainly could be the case that it is merely a property of the angelic splendor, of the angelic majesty that would cause it to be so radiant. But it may actually relate more to where the angel came from. You know, I think of the song that we sang this morning. Open the eyes of my heart, Lord. I want to see you. Holy, holy, holy. I want to see you. High and lifted up, shining in the light of your glory. I want to see you. And I think of that song and it reminds me of Moses. You might recall Moses made such a request. You know, let me see your glory. God says, Moses, I can't let you see my glory straight on. No one can see that and live. I'll let you see the trail. And he puts him in a cleft of the rock and lets him see that. Interestingly enough, later on in the story, we see kind of a manifestation of God's glory coming from Moses. The first time Moses, you recall, went and got the tablets. When he came back, that didn't work well. The people were worshiping a calf and he broke them. So he had to go up and get it a second time. And on his second time, you know, he was in the presence of God for 40 days and 40 nights. He gets the Ten Commandments again. He comes back. Listen to this account. This is Exodus 34. Listen to what it has to say. Exodus chapter 34. You don't turn there, just listen. I'm going to read starting in verse 29. It came about when Moses was coming down from Mount Sinai and the two tablets of the testimony were in Moses' hands as he was coming down from the mountain that Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he was speaking with God. So when Aaron and all the sons of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. Now, interestingly, we find later, he goes and he tells them what he has to tell them. Verse 33 says, when he had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. And this veil, whenever he would go to speak to the Lord, he would remove the veil and speak to the Lord face to face. But when he came back to speak with the sons of Israel afterward, he would put the veil back over his face so that they wouldn't stare at him because he was radiant with this glory. It's like the Shekinah glory, the tangible splendor and radiant glory of the Lord had attached itself to Moses, at least for a time, because of his encounter. It reminds me, Stephen, you might know where this comes from. It reminds me of the lyrics of an old rock song that go, I'll tell you the lyrics, you tell me the song. Heaven send hell away, no one sings like you anymore. You know it? Black Hole Suns. It's really, the line is really a prayer. Heaven send hell away, no one sings like you anymore. And I like that line because of texts like this, because it lets my imagination kind of run wild. And I imagine the fading glory of the exiles of heaven. You know, there was a time when the enemies of heaven were able to recall the songs of heaven because they were just there. And because of that, people would readily join them and listen to them in their rebellion. You know, Satan masquerades, after all, as an angel of light. But as time goes by, the glory fades and the songs are forgotten. And suddenly, a substitute just won't do it anymore. It's not cutting it anymore. People are longing for the real thing. That idea that, look, your imitation of heaven has now gone, drifted too far away. No one sings like that anymore. We want the real thing. I think of that, and that's just my imagination, but it comes back to this idea of the glory of the Lord and how it not only manifests itself from the Lord, but all that seem to come into His presence seem to carry a bit of that glory with them. Now, look back at the text. We can discern from this. Angels are certainly not bound by the spatial limitations that we face. This angel, again, manifested himself in the cell. He didn't walk through the front door. He didn't go in the same way he's coming out, because now he's got a passenger with him. You know, it's the same thing with Sodom and Lot. You know, the angels didn't pop in to Lot and say, all right, Lot, get ready. We're going to get beamed out of here. You know, beam us up, Lord. No. They said, Lot, we got to go. And Lot said, well, let me get my stuff. And I said, no. And then they grab him by the scruff of the neck and pull him out of the city. He said, this place is getting destroyed. We can't be here. Okay? In the same way, we have the angel appearing to Peter, and it seems that haste is involved. You know, he's in there. He's like, Peter, get up, get ready, quickly. We got to go. You know, we got to get out of here. Get while the getting's good. Now, I don't think the angel was afraid of getting caught by the guards for his sake or for Peter's sake. It's not like, Peter, if you don't hurry up, you know, these guys are going to wake up and then I'm going to be stuck in here with you. We're going to be in big... No, I think the angel's probably more worried about, these guys wake up, I'm going to have to kill them all. And then, it's, you know, this whole thing that's been set up, Herod's going to come in here and he's going to find you gone and everybody else is dead and he's going to think that you guys just wiped him out. So if you could please get out of here quickly so I don't have to kill everybody, I would appreciate that. That's what I think's going on. Haste is involved, but Peter has to get up and he has to agree. Interestingly, we see the chains just fall off his hands. The angel's involvement isn't really mentioned there. It just happens. And It's also not mentioned, if you notice in verse 10, the door just opens by itself. Now you'll have to put that stuff together by yourself. I think it indicates to me that angels have the ability to operate with the outside world in ways that we do not. You know, I would have to pick the lock or use a key on the lock, or at least put my hands on it and open it, or with the door. These things are just automatically taking place as he escorts Peter out. He leads Peter out. And then we find, as quickly as the angel came, he's gone. He disappears. And that's all we get. You know, the Bible doesn't linger. The Bible doesn't tell us where he went. The Bible doesn't tell us how he went. The Bible doesn't tell us anything else about him, really. It's interesting to me, looking at this text, also especially after having spent all week in other mankind's idea of creation accounts, fabrications of creation's accounts. It's interesting to me that the Bible seems almost completely disinterested in the matters that seem to interest us the most. You know, the supernatural. We want to know what's going on behind the scenes where we can't see. Tell me about God and the angels and how did the devil's angels fall? What happened with all that? What are they doing now today? The Bible is completely disinterested. They pop up only as they are relevant to what God is presently doing in the scene, and then they leave without any more explanation about them. The Bible doesn't dwell onto it. It's another indication of a supernatural book to me, because a man wouldn't do that. You'd want to talk it. If I think about books today, you know, My Trip to Heaven, or whatever the latest one is, you know, these books that people publish about their near-death experience when they think that they've traveled to heaven, they'll come back, and then they got, you know, 250 pages about everything they saw and what Jesus looks like and how your family's doing and all that mess. The Bible doesn't give us anything about that. In fact, the people that go there, like Paul says, well, I went there, but I was not permitted to come back and say anything about it. So, well, man, if mom is the word for Paul, what's going on with this other story over here? See, the Bible's not a book that we would come up with. That's not how we would tell the story. But that's how God tells the story, because he wants us to focus on what he is doing in this world through his church. Now, notice, Peter comes to. You know, it's comical, really. When we think of these angel stories, normally the first thing the angel has to say to people is what? Do not fear, right? Because they're pretty terrifying beings. And usually that's after they pick up whoever it was from the ground, because they normally pass out with fear. So even John, you know, in the book of Revelation, passes out. Okay, when I come to, okay, don't fear. Let me tell you what's going on here. Peter thinks the whole thing's a dream. So the angel might have been hurt. You know, all right, Peter, don't. Oh, well, okay, whatever. Let's just move on. Fine. Get yourself together. You know, it seems like he just kicks him. It says he struck Peter's side. I don't know if that was his first choice, because he can clearly talk. But he strikes Peter. Peter gets up, gets on his way out, comes to John Mark's house. Now notice it, verse 13. When he knocks on the door at the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. And when she recognized Peter's voice, because of her joy, she didn't open the gate. But she ran in and announced that Peter was standing in front of the gate. Sounds like something Piper would do. They said to her, "You're out of your mind." But she kept insisting that it was so. And they kept saying, "Well, it is his angel." Do the angels have problems getting in the gates? No. It's his angel. But Peter continued knocking. And when they had opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of the prison, and he said, "Report these things to James and the brethren." And he left and went to another place. Now, what were the people at Mary's house for again? Prayer. And who were they praying for? Verse 5 says they were praying for Peter. Which is very interesting, because Peter arrives and I ask, you know, did they expect an answer to that prayer? Like, he's not out there. He's in prison. Well, what are you guys here for? It also makes me question the content of their prayer. Sometimes we do this. Say we have a loved one who is sick, right? They've got something bad. Let's say cancer, you know, and we want to pray for this loved one, but we don't want to ask for what we really want, like them to be cured by God's special grace and his magnificent power, because we think, That won't happen. So let's just pray that they'll pass easily. Now we want that too, if the Lord's will is that they pass. That they pass with as little pain as possible. But we want to make our petitions known. We see it seems that oftentimes, in my experience, this has been the case, that we are reluctant to avail ourselves of God's mighty desires to love us in amazing ways through the granting of our petitions as a community that fervently comes to Him and boldly asks for what only He can do. And I look at a text like this and see this, and I suspect if there's the same kind of thing. Lord, Peter's going to get executed. We ask that you would help him to maintain his testimony on his way out, to die like a good Christian. Now, the Lord's breaking him out of prison. Tonight, immediately, prayer answered. The meeting's not even over. And it's a surprise. I look at this and another question I ask, and it also relates to our petitions and prayer, is why was Peter spared and James not? The son of Zebedee. I think that this is a question we all struggle with at times. Why one and not the other? Why a child and not a grandparent? You know, why are you spared? Some come back with survivor's guilt from war. Why was I spared and my buddy not? These kind of questions, they're not questions that have good answers that we can readily grasp onto. The only answer that we can have comes through the knowledge of the character of the one that we serve. Is God good? Does He know what He's doing? Does He have a plan? And can we trust that He's going to make decisions that not only benefit our loved one, but that He has good plans for us in the meantime? As we have to carry on with this unnatural separation, with this intrusion upon the world that we call death. The answer lies not in finding out the specific, well, Peter was spared because the gospel still had to go out to this, and this place. God doesn't need Peter. He can use Paul, and He will. He can use anyone who makes themselves available. The hand of God is for and will use. He's not limited. But we have to trust His plans. We have to trust the goodness of His decisions as we await the return of the King who will resurrect all of us and make things right. Now look at verse 18. The story is going to take one more turn before it ends today. Now when the day came, there was no small disturbance among the soldiers as to what could have become of Peter. You think? The guy sitting beside him wake up with the chains attached to them and there ain't nothing there? They're saying, explain please. When Herod had searched, verse 19, for Peter and had not found him, he examined the guards in order that they be led away to execution. And when he went down from Judea to Caesarea and was spending time there. Now, this is very interesting. If you were a guard, and you were one of the four squads sitting in that prison, and Peter was there, and Peter were to tell you, or somebody else were to come and tell you the night before, while everything was on lockdown in this maximum security prison, that when the next day comes, Peter's going to have walked out of this place scot-free without any harm coming to him. But every one of you guys that are guarding him, y'all are all going to be sent to execution. What would they say? Are you crazy? Open up your eyes. You think this guy's getting off and we're going to die? Are you not living in reality, man? Look around you. Now, I think that kind of thought is a perfect example of the biblical story. It's the biblical story. What does Hebrews 11 say? Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. That doesn't mean that we're trusting in blind faith and some sort of pipe dream out there, some sort of wishful thinking. It means that one is trusting in a future that has been revealed to be true, but that you can't see in the now time. I can't see it in the present. I am hoping for it, and I am trusting in it, and I am expecting it. I am trusting in something that I have evidence but is not presently realized. You know, I have faith that my in-laws are coming over on Wednesday. They told me they're coming. They've shown themselves to be reliable in the past. But guess what? When we get home today, they're not going to be there. They're not going to be at the house. They're not there now, but I trust that they are coming in the future. That is the faith of Scripture. The father in Proverbs tells the son, "Son, you got to look out for the adulterous woman. That thing looks good now. I'm telling you, it leads to death. Instead, you need to look to woman wisdom. It doesn't make sense to your eyes. She doesn't seem like the one that can bring you the pleasure that the adulterous woman can. But she's telling you, turn to the wife of your youth. That is where life is. This way will end in your death. This will lead to your life." I think of that. It's this concept of not trusting in what we see or what we feel or what we reason to be good, but trusting in what God has revealed to be good. And Revelation says that what He has revealed to be good is life that is in the future through Christ. It says that judgment is coming. We'll find the repeated question throughout the epistles as we go. The antagonists they only got one line. Judgment isn't coming. The world has continued on in this same way since the very beginning. What makes you think that judgment is coming now? Last time I checked, it hasn't come yet. So we should enjoy pleasure in the now time, because life is now one and done, YOLO. You know, you only live once, so let's make the most of it. The message of the Bible is that judgment is coming. And it may look like evil is winning in the now time, in the present. Judgment is coming though, guys. When? When Christ comes. When Christ comes and all those who are His get delivered into the kingdom. The biblical faith is a faith and trust in a future. It is a hope in the future time. Look at verse 20. So the soldiers, they're wiped out. What about Herod? Now he was very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon. And with one accord they came to him, having won over Blastus, the king's chamberlain. What a name. And they were asking for peace because their country was fed by the king's country. And on an appointed day, Herod, having put on his royal apparel, took his seat on the rostrum and began, that's the judgment seat, and began delivering an address to them. And the people kept crying out, "The voice of a god and not a man." And immediately, an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give God the glory. And he was eaten by worms and died. Now that's very interesting. You know what I find interesting about this situation? It doesn't say that the angel suddenly appeared and struck him and he died. It just says that this happened, yada, yada, yada. And immediately the angel took him out. It's as if the angel was there all along, watching him wake up, watching him go through his morning routine, watching him brush his teeth, watching him eat his breakfast, watching him go to the prison to check on Peter, watching him question the guards when Peter isn't found, watching him condemn them to their execution, following him as he goes to Caesarea, waiting with him as he takes his judgment seat, and then bam, he goes too far, and then the angel acts. It's very interesting. Now, we've seen concepts like that. Daniel talked a little bit about spiritual warfare, about the angels that are attached, you know, the prince of Persia, the prince of Greece, that angels and demons are vying for influence over these rulers, over nations, and we saw their kind of interaction with one another. In that, it seems very similar to that here. Obviously, we're still dealing with the protection of God's people. And it interests me because I think of all the things that go on in the unseen realm that we may be oblivious to. I think of Balaam. You remember the story of Balaam? Balaam and his donkey. Balaam was fine until he tried to go down a road that the Lord had already said don't go down, and what was waiting for him on the road? An angel to take him out. The donkey isn't having it. It's trying to get out of the way, saying, "Stop kicking me. I'm trying to save your life here." But we see the active involvement of the heavenly messengers in the physical world for what? For the honoring of God, the honoring of His glory, the restraining of evil, and the protection of believers. It's a very interesting aspect of the story. Everybody who opposed, they're wiped out. Peter who followed, he's delivered. And then we find the epilogue. Back to Paul and Barnabas. Meanwhile, the word of the Lord continued to grow, verse 24, and be multiplied. And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their mission, taking along with them John, who was called Mark. Now I think about a text like this, and I ask, what relevance does it have to us today? I think that among the various dangers that we face as followers in Christ who are interested in serving the Lord is the question of what kind of interest and relationship should we have to the spiritual world. It's very easy to become someone who's kind of an extremist in that regard. If you notice, Peter and the church don't have a discussion about how they need to go hop in and help this angel out or support them or pray for the angel to do this or that for them. There's no discussion, there's no command in the Bible at all to get involved in that kind of spiritual warfare. The spiritual warfare that the Bible commends us to, what we need to be worried about, is not trying to pray that the demon of America or whatever be overthrown. It's that we go out and take thoughts captive, that we present the gospel, and that we explain the reason for our hope in the future return of Christ. Why we have confidence in the now time that He will come and deliver in the future. That's our marching orders to participate in this great spiritual battle that is raging in the present darkness. Not to know the names of the demon of Argentina or whatever. I think that we have to look at texts like this and take a healthy position towards the spiritual realm. Demons are real. Didn't nothing change now that we're in the modern realm? People still suffer from demon oppression, demon attacks, demon possession. All that's real. But your job isn't to go out and attack demons. Your job is to present the gospel.